long meetings.
All right, we are back in session, and we have the Rosewood Initiative representatives here. Jenny, do you want to kick it off for us?
Sure. Good afternoon. My name is Jenny Glass. I'm the executive director of the Rosewood Initiative. I'm not going to take a ton of time. But last year, members of our staff and community participated with Bill Cunningham and others from BPS for the Better Housing by Design listening sessions and workshops at Rosewood. Through this process and through lots and lots of other community engagement throughout the years, we have heard loud and clear from our neighbors that multifamily housing in East Portland is not currently meeting the needs of our community for a variety of reasons. So I think you're all aware of multifamily development in East has not been designed or regulated in a way that creates safe and healthy living environment for residents. These East Portland code amendments presented in this draft are a critical start to changing that trend. Much of the existing multifamily housing in East was really not built to support people with children and has not done enough to help catalyze healthy whole neighborhoods. And because of the lack of connected street grid and lack of amenities like commercial districts and parks in East County, we need multifamily housing to provide at least some of that on-site, outdoor, and community, and even small business spaces. Even with the recent investments in parks in East Portland, we still have a really long way to go before all people can access, safely access public open spaces with their families. Also, the commercial development pattern in East really reflects an era of suburbia that's just no longer relevant to how a lot of folks in East Portland actually live. People currently have to travel several miles to do their basic shopping and meet their basic needs. New multifamily housing in East Portland has the opportunity to change this by requiring outdoor space and creating ground floor community and even commercial space for organizations and local businesses to serve the community. We're hopeful that you'll approve these amendments and continue to do more to make all of the neighborhoods in East Portland great communities to live, work, and play.
Thanks Jenny. Appreciate it. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Is this working?
There we go.
My name is Ken Marks. I'm the Director of Transportation Equity at the Rosewood Initiative. As you know, my area of interest is transportation, so I'm going to come at this from that perspective. East Portland development, as Jenny just mentioned, is from a bygone day where the auto was the preeminent means of transportation. Thus, the street network does not support alternative modes like walking, biking, or accessing transit. This plan goes a long way towards doing that in many ways. One is creating a better connectivity network for pedestrians so that they can get from the inner part of the mega blocks to the corridors where the transit exists. That's a major thing, and we really push that when we're going through this process. And we thank BPS for being open to ensuring that connectivity for pedestrians was a major part of this for the East Portland segment. Another aspect of why this is beneficial to East Portlanders is just the way that the apartments will, or multifamily housing will be oriented towards the street. The way currently that they're oriented is way off of the streets, where people have to go through parking lots, where people, you know, are at risk, especially children and people with disabilities, seniors. This reorients the housing to the corridors and makes the access to transit much easier and makes just the walkability much easier for people. The addition of, you know, businesses on the ground floor increases people's ability to walk to places as opposed to driving to meet their needs. I want to also touch on something that the professor from PSU had highlighted. East Portland is a heat island in the summer, and it is essentially an iceberg in the winter. This plan will address those problems, and those problems create barriers to people walking and people getting to transit. If it's 90 degrees outside or 100 degrees outside and you're walking along asphalt with no shade, then, and you've got a health issue, then you're probably not going out. You're not going to that doctor's appointment. You're not going to meet with your friends. You're not doing those things because it is unbearable. You are at risking your life when you do that. And that is not hyperbole. That is a real fact. If you have children, you are less likely to walk along or in those conditions. There's another thing that the professor didn't mention that you should also be aware of. The environment, the built environment, has psychological impacts on people as well as physical impacts. If you don't have greenery, then, and you don't have those things that make you want to be out and walking, that increases your stress. Portland State has done a numerous project or studies on this. That stress has physiological impacts on you, and not just adults, but children. Again, this plan will go to or work towards addressing those problems, and in so doing, it will make accessing or using alternative means other than a car much easier for people, and that has many impacts or benefits, including climate crisis. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. All right, that concludes our panel discussion. So now we're going to open up the floor for public testimony. Carla's going to read the names, 3 minutes each, please. And if you could just state your name for the record, we don't need to know your street address or anything like that, unless you'd like everybody in the city to know.
I show 32 people left on the list.
All right, we'll just get through as many as we can. I have to leave at about 10 till, but we'll get us through as many as we can today.
Okay, first three, please, coming up are Terry Parker, Fred Leeson, and Lawrence Kojaku. Sorry.
Thank you, and welcome, and thank you for your patience. Because I need more coffee. Yeah. Terry, do you want to start for us, please?
Terry Parker, Northeast Portland, fourth generation Portlander. Close to 89% of households in the Portland metro area have one or more cars. 72% of households living in apartment complexes with no off-street parking have one or more cars. Between 2010 and 2035, Portland's growth rate is projected to include 260,000 more people, which equates to 123,000 more households. Included with the majority of these households is approximately 100,000 more cars. Car trips are expected to increase by 49% regardless of how much mass transit is added. Adequate off-street parking needs to be required with all new residential development, be it close to transit or not. For people with electric cars, adequate means on-site overnight charging access with no need to run long extension cords across sidewalks or down the block. While 59% of low-income people drive to their place of employment, for people who use alternative modes to commute, adequate off-street parking means a safe place to store their cars, possibly for days at a time. Moreover, adequate parking requires no less than 3 spaces for every 4 units, with 1 space per unit preferred. Per both TriMet and Metro surveys, congestion, road maintenance, and the need to increase motor vehicle capacity and infrastructure were among the top transportation-related priorities. Instead of engaging in failed social engineering car-hater policies that include a lack of parking and creating more congestion with road diets, the will of the survey respondents needs to be applied. No democratic city or government should be denying residents the freedom of mobility a car provides, either by dictatorial deterrent taxation or lack of infrastructure. A reality check is needed. Requiring off-street parking is both an equity and livability issue that needs to be one of the design components of better housing. The street should not be utilized for 24/7 car storage, which in turn generates negative impacts for residential neighborhoods. Such impacts include drivers circling to find a parking place. A Peabot employee recently told me the expectation is that people moving to Portland will not have cars. That's a sheer fantasy. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, sir.
Hi, my name is Fred Leeson. I'm a board member of the Architectural Heritage Center that I'm representing today. We've been following Better Housing by Design from the outset, hoping to find ways to achieve greater density without denigrating the scale and context of our historic districts, notably the Alphabet District, Kings Hill, and Irvington. And for Commissioner Hardesty, I will say that the minority percentage of residents in Irvington and Alphabet districts exceed the average throughout the city. Half of the kids at Irvington School are on free lunch. We're not all wealthy. We're not all white. We've collaborated repeatedly with the neighborhood associations involved. We're appreciative of the time Bill Cunningham took to meet with us and to hear our ideas and discuss potential outcomes. Personally, I believe his attitude has helped restore the concept of citizen planning that many of us feel has been greatly devalued in Portland in recent years. I'll touch briefly on three elements currently in the plan that we support and encourage you to adopt. First is the rearrangement of zones in the Alphabet District that is intended to make the new buildings more compatible with the scale of the historic buildings. Second, the largest scale zone RM4 is defined differently in historic districts than elsewhere. The base floor area ratio is somewhat lower, again to make the buildings more compatible with the scale of the largest historic apartment buildings. This is somewhat the issue that Kristen Miner was addressing, and I endorse her testimony. Third, the plan expands opportunities for floor area ratios to be transferred from historic buildings to other buildings in all multifamily zones if proceeds from the transfers are used to help finance the cost of seismic bracing of the historic buildings. That's just one approach that can help the seismic issue. Of course, the preservation community so far has not achieved all that we might want to wish, that we would wish for. Imagine that. Our president, Steve Dodderer, submitted a detailed written testimony, although he could not be here today. Larry Kojaku, who sits beside me, is a member of our planning committee, and he will summarize key elements that remain on our wish list. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Hardesty. Good afternoon.
One moment.
Excuse me for just a sec. Thank you, Mayor. I just want to say I used to have a house in Irvington, mm-hmm. and I'm not rich or white, so my implication was not that everybody in historic districts are rich.
Thank you.
However, I want to be very clear. The way we've done land use planning has benefited some communities at the expense of others.
No problem. And also, I can say as an Irvington resident that Irvington was also a victim of redlining for many, many years.
Well, we could talk about
Thank
that.
You.
It depends on what side of the street you were on and whether or not you were
Which side of 15th, yeah.
Side of 15th. I was on the other side, so I know what you're talking about.
Good afternoon.
I'm Larry Kojaku from the Advocacy Committee of the Architectural Heritage Center. We are requesting three changes to the recommended draft, as you can see on the second page of our handout. First, we ask that the zoning map of the Kings Hill Historic District be further revised by assigning the RM3 zone to a few blocks containing mostly historic houses, as shown on the map attached to your handout. We are asking for the same rationale, the pattern of scale of historic buildings that was correctly applied to rearranging the zones in the Alphabet District to be applied to Kings Hill. This would have little effect on housing capacity since immediately outside the historic district boundary, the recommended draft upzones the equivalent of over three blocks. Second, we ask that historic districts be excluded from the 100-foot height allowance within 1,000 feet of a MAX station, as was done in the original proposed draft. Restoring this exclusion would be consistent with the exclusion of historic districts from 100-foot heights near streets with frequent bus service. In the few blocks of the Alphabet District affected by this 10-story height allowance, there are no buildings even half as tall, so required approval by the Landmarks Commission would be very unlikely. Please note that this height allowance does not require affordable units beyond the citywide minimum, while the default RM4 zone would require increasing proportions of affordable units to gain additional size and height. Finally, we ask that a provision be added that denies bonuses and transfers to sites in historic districts where a historic building is demolished. Because the recommended draft does not not only applies all development incentives to historic districts, but greatly increases them, a higher threat of demolition is inevitable, since historic districts are largely built out. We have no objection to the demolition of non-contributing buildings, but the demolition of historic buildings should not be rewarded with additional allowances. These changes are minor in the context of citywide zoning, but would have a huge impact on fragile historic districts with vulnerable historic buildings. I'd like to mention that just as national parks belong to all Americans, historic districts that are listed in the National Register of Historic Places belong to all of us, and we really need to protect them. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your handout as well. Appreciate it. Next three, please, Carla.
Are Doug Klotz, Michael Anderson, and Tony Jordan.
Welcome. Thank you for being here. Thanks for your patience. You want to
Thank
go
you.
Ahead and start?
Hi. Thanks. I'm Doug Klotz. There's a handout. But I'm here representing, it looks like this, I'm here representing Inner Southeast Action, which is a community group embracing change to promote livability, inclusivity, sustainability, and climate protection, and we also support housing affordability. Better housing by design will increase the number of units that can be built near jobs, transit, and shopping, which will result in less driving, less carbon emissions. As REACH CDC said, it will promote affordable housing and better housing across the city. We support all the changes proposed, especially the change from unit count to FAR in calculations. This will allow more units, and there's also inclusionary zoning, and additionally, the deep affordability bonus in CM2 that Bill told you about. We do support FAR transfers to preserve affordable housing and to preserve trees, and we also support transferring it into historic districts as the Planning and Sustainability Commission's supported. Along with Portlanders for Parking Reform, we support elimination of parking requirements in all multifamily zones, including more than 500 feet from transit, where demand is less and transit is still an easy walk. And 500 feet is like two blocks. We support reduction of side setbacks to 5 feet and reduced front setbacks, which will give you more flexibility. If there's a tree in the backyard, you can slide the building toward the street. If the tree's in front, you can slide the building back. But with a built-in max, required setback in front, you sometimes are not given that flexibility. The other thing I want to mention in regard to trees and heat islands is we need to get more street trees, and we're getting less and less with every new building. There's a PBOT initiative called Streets 2035, which is private meetings that I can't go to, but the vaults and the sidewalk are precluding street trees. Look at the new buildings around downtown. There's like blank sidewalks with no trees. So that needs to be addressed everywhere. We support PBOT's Connected Centers project in East Portland. And we do have some concerns about the FAR in inner corridors like Belmont and Division, which is, we think, too low to take full advantage of the good transit service there. It could be that we may need to talk about changing the zoning, just moving some of the better housing by design zones to move them around a little to get a higher rate in there. So, but otherwise, we support that. I wanted to talk a little about the Alphabet District, and especially what Ms. Miner said. I think that in a historic district, you look at Europe, they build new big buildings right next to 300-year-old buildings. But the Landmarks Commission's testimony, the PLAC strongly opposes opportunity to earn more bulk in these areas, in other words, get more FAR for having affordable housing, even for deeply needed affordable housing. That's their words. So I think we need to have some relook at how we treat historic districts.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Mr. Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Michael Anderson. I live near the 60th Avenue MAC stop. I'm a senior researcher at Sightline Institute. It's a sustainability think tank for the Pacific Northwest. I think of myself as an analyst more than an advocate, but I'm speaking today on behalf of my colleague Madeline Kovacs, who's unable to attend. She'll be submitting Sightline's generally supportive letter to the record. Better Housing by Design, she says, has improved in many ways in the last 4 years. Sightline's analysis is that this reform will improve affordability and reduce aggregate displacement while legalizing greener housing amid our climate crisis. She also wanted me to say that Sightline disagrees strongly with the recommendation to push front setbacks from 3 to 10 feet. Sidewalk stoops are perfectly suited to a vibrant urban environment, and hundreds, if not thousands, of homes might be lost over a 20-year period if all new buildings have to give up that space. It's not just about those 7 feet. It's about the fact that they make possible the entire project and pay for the good things like inclusionary housing and other costs that are carried along with the project. I'm also here to briefly present research on one particular aspect of the proposal before you, the effect of parking on affordability. The following numbers don't come from us. They come from the city's website inside the modeling that the city contracted. So here are the city's own findings. What the analysis found was that on a 10,000 square foot lot in the new RM2 zone in a relatively close in Portland neighborhood like the one I personally rent in, two scenarios are the most likely. Scenario one is a row of 10 townhomes that sell for $730,000 each with zero below market homes. Scenario two is a mixed income condo building, including 4 privately financed community land trust homes that are affordable to those preschool teachers and nursing assistants, and 28 brand new market rate units that cost just $280,000. That comes to a monthly mortgage payment of $1,400, so affordable to the second year elementary school teacher, PPS, or 2 retail workers who make $12 an hour. There's no question which of those two scenarios is better for affordability and for the climate. There's one thing that makes a difference between those two scenarios, and that is whether or not off-street parking is required. If the homes are required to have garages, either by the government or by the bank that writes the construction loan, then townhomes are the likeliest option. If no parking is required, then the mixed-income condo will be the likeliest option. You can see that in the slides here. These bars basically show the probability of different projects happening. The first shows that with parking, the likeliest project is the $703,000 townhomes. The second chart shows a world without on-site parking where the likeliest project becomes the mixed-income flats where even the market-rate homes are just $280,000. Removing the city parking requirement will not guarantee mixed-income condos are built. Lenders may require the building to have those anyway, but given these city findings, it would seem very, very strange for the city to require parking anywhere in this zone. Most Portland households own cars and will continue to, and building practices will reflect this. But there's nowhere in Portland that auto storage is more important than housing, and the city's laws should reflect that too.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Tony Jordan, and I'm going to follow up and talk a little bit more about parking, as you might expect. I agree with everything Michael just said. I strongly encourage reading his post that went out on Sightline today. It's very informative and well-researched. And I'm going to speak specifically, add a little bit more about these parking requirements. So Better Housing by Design, anything that's already exempted from parking, which is near transit, is exempted from further parking requirements. And also, lots that are smaller than 10,000 square feet are exempted. So actually, most of the zones that are affected by Better Housing Design don't have parking requirements already. I believe it's only like 1,000 lots in the city that would be impacted by these parking requirements. And most of them are just outside of the border. So this is, I don't know if you can see this, this is just an example of where the parking is required near Ladd's Addition. And you have these little pockets that are just, you know, like, no one would say that this street, which is Salmon Street, is a bad place to live without a car. But our current requirements, because they're just as arbitrary based on 500 square feet from a transit stop, leave little places out. We have an example of this at the Sunshine Dairy over by 20th and the Banfield. It's 70 feet too far, and as a result, they have to seek a variance to have no parking. So I just wonder, what is really the big danger to eliminating these requirements that only really apply to 1,000 spaces anyway? There's another wrinkle, which is Better Housing by Design smartly makes parking somewhat more environmental. I don't believe you can actually have environmentally friendly parking, but it does require more permeability and covered parking spaces. That makes parking that you do have to build more expensive. So if we are requiring parking on some lots, even a small amount, but we're making them more expensive, we're kind of at cross purposes to our goals. We want affordable housing and green development. So I just think that you know, in light of for climate purposes, there are other ways to manage the concerns that could come from adding housing without parking. As Michael mentioned, there will still be parking. There is a lot of structured parking that is going to be here forever, but we can advance our already developed permitting processes and neighborhood parking management toolkits in order to alleviate any problems that might pop up. Someone earlier, I think from PSU, said, you know, these structures will be here for a long, long time. We need to be looking towards a future where if everyone is still owning a car, we've messed up really badly. So I suggest cutting those 1,000 lots out of this and just getting rid of the parking requirements altogether. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, all three of you. Next three, please.
Are Lauren Murphy, Ron Chandler, and Charles Bridgecrane? I think Charles might have left. Oh, yeah, they've got it.
He had enough of it.
Looks like Charles has gone. We'll go with Alan Kessler.
Good afternoon. Would you like to go ahead and start, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
Bruce Nelson?
Mayor, Commissioners, my name is Lauren Murphy, and I am here today to address a specific property and ask for a small technical fix to Better Housing by Design that would otherwise be an extremely lengthy and potentially cost prohibitive process for us. We purchased the Jacob H. Cook House on Southeast Belmont in Mount Tabor out of auction in 2018, and we have spent the past 14 months restoring the house. The house had been abandoned for 8 years. Yeah.
Thanks.
The house had been abandoned for 8 years and had been badly vandalized, and it had been a target for a lot of illicit activity. The house was also identified as a significant historic resource in a project that the city did in the late 80s. And the neighbors and the community have just been so involved in this process, and they've been so excited, and they're really engaged, and they reach out to us daily in social media and on online, and they come by the property, and they're just really excited about the project. Anyway, we are currently looking for creative and economically viable opportunities to open this house up to the community and allow folks to be a part of this. But we are running into a significant challenge in being able to get the permitting to be able to do, to find an adaptive reuse for this project. If you look at the second page of the handout that I've given you, it shows the zoning map for this project. And you can see where that thick black line runs across the middle of the page. That's the zoning line. Everything below that is zoned R2. Everything above that line is zoned R5. And you can see where I've drawn that little circle there. 6 feet of this house sits in that R5 zone. That 6 feet represents a enclosed back porch and a small room off the kitchen. And because of that mixed zoning, we are not allowed to apply for any sort of alternative uses for the property right now. We don't have an option to share it with the community. And so what we're asking for today as part of this project, and as part of our ability to be able to do adaptive reuse, is to move that line back, the 6 feet, where you see I've drawn in that dotted line, that would allow us to go and apply for different permits, and it would give us the opportunity to open up the house to the community. Additionally,
Commissioner Hardesty,
what does that mean when you say open up the house to the community?
I believe that the house should be shared, small events, rehearsal dinners, community engagements.
So it would be a place that people could rent for community events. It's not quite the same as being open to the community. So I'm glad we have that clarification. Thank you.
We did extensive gardens around the property, and our plan was to open up those gardens to the community. And we have invited the community in-house frequently. We bring people through all the time. And so while, yes, it would be a place for small events, it's also a place that I want to open up to organizations like the Architectural Heritage Center, to different community gatherings that aren't part of a paying event option. I do believe this house should be shared, and that's why I've spent my whole life restoring it for the past 14 months. So I want it to be a part of the community. Additionally, we have been approved for a state incentive program that obligates us to apply for national and state historic designation, and we are pursuing that direction.
Great. Commissioner Fritz.
And I believe, because thank you for sending in your testimony by email in advance, you've also applied to be on the National Historic Register.
We're working on that,
working
yes.
on that. Yep. And I'm assuming that usually we don't have lots that have got one zoning on one side and two different zones.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming it would be all right with you if it was just all rezoned to R2. rather than just moving that line?
Absolutely. That doesn't change how anyone else would use the property. It doesn't change if a developer were to come in and decide to tear the house down. It doesn't change how they would be able to use the property either.
Thank you.
Let me just congratulate you. I think this is fantastic what you've done here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Hello, my name is Ron Chandler. I've also been a longtime East Portland resident for 40 years. I submitted arguments in favor of increased density, so I will just jump over reading this. I'll just read the seven highlights.
Thanks.
Also, I wanted to take a moment to commend Bill Cunningham. He has been a terrific resource and extraordinarily available. I mean, somehow or another I got his phone number. I couldn't believe every time I called, he picked up the phone. I mean, and he responded to emails. If he didn't answer the phone, he responded to emails quickly. So anyway, reasons why high density is a good idea for our city. First of all, it's geographically easier to manage school districts. It's lower cost to maintain infrastructure for governments. Sprawl doesn't pay the bills. More details on that. Low density developments often do not provide a large enough tax base to cover the cost of public services. Mixed-use developments with retail and apartments tend to pay a higher commercial tax rate and provide more services privately than communities made up of single-family homes. Higher density development helps attract new employers. Higher density development can increase property values. Believe it or not, higher density development generates less traffic than low density development per unit. While residents of low density single family communities often have two or more cars per household, residents of high density apartments and condominiums tend to have only one car per household. When public transportation is readily available, people in walkable communities will often opt to use it. And finally, it gets rid of urban blight. I did submit this document on the testimony webpage, so it's available and incomplete, and I'll yield the rest of my time.
Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Next three, please, Carla.
Was Alan Kessler here? Okay. Bruce Nelson, John Gibbon, Tracy Prince, and Daniel Solomon.
And then can I see a show of hands? How many people have not testified yet? Okay. Yeah, unfortunately, we will not be able to finish it today, but I want to promise you, if you're not testifying today, that you will be at the top of the list when we reconvene. And of course, we will take written testimony if you'd prefer. And I appreciate your patience and your forbearance. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon, or almost good evening. I want to congratulate the mayor and the commissioners for your stamina. Congratulations. My name is Bruce Nelson. I'm here this evening to speak on behalf of Trees for Life. My comments will specifically pertain to trees that relate to this particular document. One very petty suggestion is in the portion that deals with the floor area ratio standard. In regards to trees, there is reference to dead, dying, and dangerous. Later on in that section, the terms that are used are dead, diseased, and dangerous. Dying and diseased are not synonymous. It would behoove the city to delete the word diseased and only use dying. Otherwise, you open up a can of worms later on. Now, on to some more specific concerns I have. I am specifically addressing the East Portland standard. The high-density housing is going to go along highly traveled roads. There will be more housing going in there that will lead to the removal of a number of trees for these development projects. These particular neighborhoods in East County currently have an average tree canopy of 23%. The goal for the city is 30%. The current canopy level in Eastmoreland is 42%, and Laurelhurst is 38%. The results with this increased high-density housing, the removal of trees for this, and probably lack of guidance in how you include space for trees in these developments, we're going to lead to, in East Portland in particular, we're not going to meet the COMP 35 standards that are, principles that talk about environmental health and equity. These are not going to, I'll say they're inadequately met because trees are not being taken into account. I would suggest that one way to improve this would be somehow we need a comprehensive and coordinated long-term plan to improve the canopy in East Portland. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Good afternoon.
My name is John Gibbon. I'm First Vice President of Sweeney, Transportation Representative for the Markham neighborhood, which is one of the, what I want to say, Portland's south of 5, south of 99W neighborhoods in that area. I'm speaking today related to transportation issues that this project raises in the Markham neighborhood. We only have two pieces of property in Markham that are affected by this. One is an existing apartment complex on the off-ramp at 35th and Taylor's Ferry Road. And the other one is a piece of developed as a single-family parcel, but R2 zoned property at the on-ramp at Spring Garden and it's actually between, at the intersection of Southwest 20th and 21st, which really does exist in Southwest Portland. There's an intersection where two numbered streets come together, and it's right in front of this piece of property. In both those cases, the problem we have is not with the zoning. Obviously, it's already been zoned that way, and this upgrade is good. But in both cases, we don't have safe pedestrian and bicycle access from either of those properties. It's a situation where the city is going to have to take a serious look at getting us that last two or three blocks over to Spring Garden so people can walk across and get to the Barber Transit Corridor, or at 35th, they're going to have to do vegetation management so the kids that live in the apartment complex on the east side of 35th Avenue across from the state highway yards have an ability to walk the four blocks it takes to get up to Jackson Middle School. And I know Commissioner Fritz has worked with our neighborhoods over a long period of time in trying to get sidewalks along 35th, and we understand they're expensive, difficult kind of things, but if you're going to do this upzoning, which it essentially is, and you're going to say this is where we want people to live in multifamily, we've got to come to grips with the transportation issues. The existing apartment complex sees a bus for about 10 hours, 12 hours a day on the weekdays, not on the weekends. So that's the issue for Southwest.
Thank you. Appreciate your coming in, sir. Good afternoon.
Yes. My name is Daniel Salomon, and I am a disabled Section 8 renter in Goose Hollow. I'm very lucky to live in a neighborhood where the Neighborhood Association fights so hard to protect its low-income renters. People seem to have the wrong idea about the Kings Hill Historic District, which is in the Goose Hollow neighborhood. In fact, Kings Hill is not a high-income area. The median household income for Kings Hill is more than 9% lower than in the rest of Portland. Many people also seem to have the wrong idea about Goose Hollow. In fact, Goose Hollow residents are 80% renters, and half of those are low income. Our neighborhood association has worked to make sure that our board members represent our diverse demographics. Half of our neighborhood association boards are renters, and half are low income. All of our low income board members live in Kings Hill in the naturally occurring affordable housing of mid-rise apartment buildings and boogled houses that have been converted to apartments. 20% of our board are people of color. We joined the Architectural Heritage Center in the Northwest District Association and asking you to right-size the zoning to RM3 for Kings Hill and to lower height limits within 1,000 feet of the Goose Hollow MAX station, which touches part of Kings Hill and would cause demolitions. When we ask for these things, we are asking you to protect the most affordable housing in our neighborhood. Thanks very much.
Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Good evening, and I'm sorry you're going to be the last person to testify.
I made it.
Yeah, so I apologize to those of you who didn't.
So I'm Tracy Prince. I'm on the board of the Architectural Heritage Center, but I'm here as the president of the Goose Hollow Neighborhood Association, and we represent Kings Hill Historic District. It's predominantly mid-rise apartments that have our most affordable housing in Goose Hollow. We've done a Craigslist rental search, and we found that the apartments in Kings Hill are half the price per square foot of outside of Kings Hill. So it is a dramatically affordable area with naturally occurring affordable housing. More than half of our board are low-income residents, and we have many families who live, with several children living in one-bedroom apartments. This is very common on Kings Hill. And so we want to make sure everybody understands the demographic we're dealing with, because I think they see the big old houses and that's what they think is the predominant demographic. We support subdividing those big old houses and putting two historically appropriate ADUs in the backyard. We just don't want the big old houses demolished, so that's all we're asking for. The current RM4 zoning, as proposed in this draft, incentivizes the demolition of 8 buildings on Kings Hill. And if these 8 buildings were demolished, then that would cause the entire district to be delisted. When Kings Hill was created, the zoning was never changed. So we're asking to right-size the zoning at this point. Although Kings Hill is a smaller historic district than Alphabet, it was listed a decade earlier and should receive the same consideration in the zoning as the Alphabet Historic District. So we're asking for a small section to be looked at for RM3. The neighboring Kings Hill and Alphabet Historic Districts have mirror images of each other, with the larger RM4 mostly up against Burnside. The Alphabet District map was changed in this process with the support of the Northwest District Association, with a really fine grain analysis. And so we're asking for a little bit more fine grain analysis on ours with just the 8 spots. We want to set fair expectations. We have developers come to our planning committee, and they think that because it says 100 foot here that they can get it, and then we have to tell them no you can't, and then Landmarks has to tell them no you can't. So we think with the right size zoning that it just sets all the expectations from the beginning. It makes it much easier for everyone to understand what they can achieve in a historic district. And we are pro-density. We are the densest neighborhood in all of Oregon.
Very good. Well, first of all, thank you, everyone who did testify today. For those of you who did not and want to testify at the next hearing, we will still entertain your written testimony. So if you want to get that to us like tonight, we will read that and we will have it. And you can still come in and testify in person. So that concludes the council's acceptance of oral testimony for today. This public hearing is continued to Wednesday, November 6th at 2 p.m., time certain, at which time we will continue to hear additional oral testimony, starting with the people who've signed up today but did not get the opportunity to testify. The written record will remain open until November 6th, so again, please feel free to send us your emails. We will read them. When council reconvenes, we may introduce amendments if at the time council determines additional public testimony is warranted for any proposed amendments. The council may reopen the record for the limited purpose of testimony on those amendments. Did I get everything, legal counsel?
Yes.
Very good. And I'll just say this. This was some of the best public testimony I've heard in a long time. People spent a ton of time preparing for this, and it showed. And I want to thank you, and I look forward to reading and or hearing the testimony from those of you who did not get a chance to testify today. So with that, we are adjourned.
What's your evening event?
And you may think that's impossible.
Oh my goodness. Well, I have the Regional Water Consortium Board tonight.
No, nope, mine's fun. Mine's more fun. You lose.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you're welcome. Dinner. Oh, great. I apologize.